Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Well, it's surprising in one way that there's been very little discussion about the upcoming divorce referendum. There hasn't seemed to be, you haven't heard, I haven't certainly anyway, heard much of a kind of debate on yes versus no. But at the end of the day, on the 24th of May, we have to use our vote and speak with our feet. And it's important that we inform ourselves. So in studio with me now, I have Pádraig Maher from our news department, who has is just going to kind of lay out. I mean, yesterday we looked at the legal side with Carl Hutchinson, who's just looking at purely the legal implications. But what is it actually all about in terms of the implications of a yes vote and a no vote? What is the current law that we have, and what are some concerns that maybe you might have around it? So Pádraig is going to go through some of that with us. So thanks, Pádraig, for breaking it down for us. So let's start with that. What is the law now, and what's the proposal?
So currently, divorce in Ireland is allowed where a marriage is considered broken down for at least 4 years. Now, the time restriction is in the Constitution, and the referendum would simply delete it. The Oireachtas would then be free to institute its own time restriction and amend it if as it sees fit at any time in the future without needing to go back to the people. So the present government say if the referendum passed, they would introduce a 2-year waiting period for divorce. But here's the first problem with this idea, because if there is an election in October and a new, more liberal coalition comes into power, they might prefer a waiting period shorter than 2 years, say 1 year or 6 months. Or indeed, even if this present government stays in power, they might decide 3 years from now, they might reduce the waiting period again.
Yeah, and that I think is one of the concerns I've heard, you know, this idea of quickie divorces. But it's an interesting trend that we seem to have seen in the last number of referendums. Rather than amending the Constitution, which is so, so important to most Irish citizens, rather than amending it, it takes a particular clause out totally and puts then the power in the hands of this or future governments. Is that a kind of dangerous road to be going down? Because leaving aside the issue at hand, and we'll get more into the actual referendum, but, you know, taking something that is written down that gives kind of sovereignty to the people and saying, okay, politicians, you or future politicians can decide where this goes.
Well, the argument that has been given over the last few years is that legislators don't like to see the mechanics of legislation or the details being put into constitution. They prefer instead to see principles enunciated. So that was why in this present situation, they don't like the fact that there are definite things written in there. Now, interestingly, when this proposal was first put forward by Josepha Madigan in 2016, she proposed that they would simply reduce the waiting period in the Constitution itself. But then subsequent to that, once the government saw how much support there was for the abortion referendum, they were emboldened to make this particular proposal more liberal.
And give themselves more power, essentially.
Essentially, yeah. Give themselves completely a way to legislate in the future.
Is that, in a way, again, trying to be a bit dispassionate about the actual issue at hand, is that, in a way, providing, whether it's abortion, whether it's, you know, the time that you have to wait to get divorced, providing more political footballs to be kicked around in the future, because politicians can then use these things in kind of emotive ways to try and win the electorate?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is one of the worrying things about the campaign as we're seeing it right now. It's already being played on an emotional sphere. So, for instance, when the Fine Gael campaign for a yes vote was launched on Monday, one of the speakers talked about the 4-year waiting period. It prolongs the punishment of divorce. Now, likewise, when Minister Madigan herself spoke, she said there needs to be an equilibrium between making sure that people don't have a knee-jerk reaction, while at the same time not unduly punishing them. So even the government is using this language that a long waiting period for divorce is a kind of a punishment. But the funny thing about that then is, if you take that argument to its logical conclusion, you don't have an argument then to limit the waiting period to at least 2 years. So that's why that's one of the concerns that people have. Even the very argument that the government is using undercuts the proposal which they're putting to us.
In terms of the kind of genesis of this proposal, I know obviously it was Minister Madigan, as you mentioned, but was it coming from kind of a grassroots drive from people, you know, just ordinary citizens saying this is an issue, you know, those who'd been through separation and divorce, or is it coming from the top down, do you think?
Well, there certainly wasn't a popular countrywide movement for it. Josepha Madigan, as mentioned, she was elected to the Dáil first in 2016. Now, she had a background as a solicitor working in family law, so she certainly would have had a lot of experience with people going through this process, as it was something which was which she was intimately acquainted with. She then put forward this proposal as a private member's bill, and it was later then adopted by the government.
Okay, so in terms of then, I suppose, arguments in favour of the proposal, so taking it out of the constitution, I think we've touched on the for a lot of people, they might have kind of two minds in terms of, you know what, I can see the logic of reducing the waiting period, but it's a different thing taking out of the constitution. And there hasn't been a big government campaign on it. So is the government just kind of assuming, it's just going to pass and we don't really need to do much campaigning on it?
Yeah, they've put forward their argument and then they've quickly followed it up by this idea that, oh, people shouldn't be complacent about this. So I think they're a tad worried that everybody is just going to presume that it's going to be passed. So they're a little more concerned about making sure that they get out the vote.
So what is the key arguments from the government's perspective then?
Now, one of the arguments that the government has mentioned is that people would be less likely to engage in judicial separations and more likely to engage in divorce if they reduce the time period. Because as it is, people can get a judicial separation after 12 months, whereas if they have to wait 4 years if they wish to get a divorce. Now, there's almost
What's the difference between the two?
Great question. There's almost no difference between the two, except that divorce allows you to remarry. Judicial separation doesn't.
Okay, so then a lot of people who are, you know, really wanting to make that separation would probably go for that as the first port of call, and then if they meet somebody else, go for a divorce after that. You're reading between the lines of many different complicated situations, but then you could say, well, why didn't they just make the waiting period 12 months then?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point, and that's a question which I have not heard the government answer yet. And there certainly are many voices who are in the legal profession who are saying, let's just make it 12 months. But the idea that reducing the divorce period to 2 years would then make judicial separation superfluous, it flies in the face of reality because, of course, people will still, they'll be saying, look, I can get this judicial separation, I can get all of our affairs cleared up, I can get the financial, the property settlement all done, but I'll still have to wait another 12 months if I want to go for a divorce.
The thing is, when a proposal like this is put forward, obviously, ultimately, we're talking about marriage. And there's been very little discussion on, at the end of the day, we're talking about marriages in trouble, but there's been very little discussion on marriage is a good thing, marriage matters, marriage is good for society, it's good for children. And I'm not hearing any of our government representatives talking about how to help marriages that might be in trouble. Because, you know, I don't think anybody would argue that you know, separation or divorce is a positive, or anybody enters into it lightly or whatever. But nobody's really talking about, well, how can we try and help these families in the first place, perhaps before they get to that point?
Yeah, again, this is one of the concerns that people have in terms of the prudential thinking that our politicians are showing about the issue of marriage itself. There seems to be a dearth of real thought. So on the one hand, as you mentioned, how come they're not putting more time and effort into preparing people for marriage? On the other hand, why aren't they putting more time and effort into helping people to try to find a means of reconciliation when their marriages hit the doldrums? Thirdly, how come they're not spending more time looking into and explaining why it is that marriage is considered a good? Why it is that there's a good there to be protected, that the law should be involved to protect and promote it? Why it is that we should be giving tax breaks to marriage? And likewise then, if you look at the trajectory of legislation over the last few years, from the introduction of no-fault divorce, as opposed to fault-based divorce, and especially the introduction of same-sex marriage, they seem to have cut off why it is that we should support marriage. In other words, that it's there in order to give a lifelong platform for the procreating and raising of children.
and the importance that that plays in the overall, you know, building of a positive society. And that's, you know, I don't think many people would argue with that, just in terms of the ripple effect of good, strong, healthy marriages. So is there a danger then with discussions like these that marriage will, you know, it's interesting because obviously you mentioned the same-sex marriage referendum, and of course that was a time when we heard so many politicians proselytizing about marriage matters, marriage is important, etc., etc., etc. And now it's kind of flipped, where we're saying, I suppose proposals like this, one could argue, we're saying, well, it isn't that important because we're not talking about support and adequate preparation and all that sort of stuff. And are we going to make marriage so meaningless that there's no real difference between, say, you know, being married to somebody and cohabiting?
Yeah, and I mean, I think in some ways that has already occurred in part because of the fact that judicial separation is available on for no fault grounds after merely 12 months. So like another way of looking at the whole thing is if you say once upon a time, okay, back in 1986, if you got married, you had a guarantee for life that the legal structure of marriage would remain in place. Now, when divorce was originally brought in other countries, it was fault-based, which meant that you still had a guarantee that your legal marriage would last for life unless you yourself did something serious to break it down, such as betrayal or violence or unreasonable behavior. Or if your spouse did that, then you could decide to do so, but because it's fault-based, you would get a greater share of the proceeds. However, with the intro of no-fault divorce, your guarantee then reduces merely to the minimum time period to wait. So that means in Ireland from 1995, all you were guaranteed was 4 years that this would last. Whereas now we're looking at reducing it to 2 years. But in actual fact, with judicial separation, with the no-fault judicial separation, you only have a guarantee of 12 months that this legal structure would be in place. And that doesn't seem to be enough for the lifelong relationship that would be the natural institution of marriage, and the kind of thing which would be most appropriate for raising children in an intact home with their mother and father.
I suppose as it's already been something that's raised in terms of, well, let's make it 12 months, it's probably not too far a leap to think, well, maybe that's the direction it's going in. Just to sum up then, does it simply come down to, you know, in terms of advocating a yes vote, obviously it's about trying to make it, you know, less of a painful and costly process, and that, you know, 4 years is too long, and at the end of the day, if the marriage is going to break up, 2 years is more reasonable. And then on the other hand, does it just come down to, for those advocating a no vote, do you trust politicians by taking this out of the Constitution?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the reasons why there's not greater opposition to this is because the figures show that in general there's not much difference between those who wait for 4 years to go for a divorce or those who wait for 2 years to go for a divorce. But the additional concern, as mentioned, is that people don't want to put it entirely in the hands of the politicians because they don't trust them. So I think that is going to be what it's going to come down to.
Pádraig, thanks so much for explaining the upcoming divorce referendum. It is time now to chat to our life coach, Mark Fennell. And today we're going to be talking about toxic friendships. So what is it? Or toxic relationships of any kind. You know, it could be a friend, it could be a loved one, it could be a sibling. Or are you the toxic friend? Are you the toxic person and you just don't know it? So what do you do about it? Can you move on? Do you have to cut that person out of your life? Well, Mark's going to be giving us some great advice on that this morning. So, Mark, have you had any toxic friends in your life?
Oh, there may have been one or two. Thanks very much for having me on air, by the way. And happy Thursday already. Well, you know what? It is when it comes to, I suppose, toxic friendships, toxic relationships. And I want to kind of differentiate the two, because when it comes to toxic friendship, it's a little bit different rules than a toxic relationship. And if a couple is in a marriage, you still can have toxicity, if that's the word. You still can have toxicity in that relationship, which can be resolved, but it can be resolved a little bit differently at times. So see the two is a little bit different.
Well, overall, start with friendships, maybe. How would you define a toxic friendship?
All right, well, you know, there is a couple of things that I always kind of would share with people, because sometimes when I'm coaching someone, it may come up and they may not realize a lot of the time that we're in a toxic friendship. We have this relationship in our lives that is, you know, for the most part, what we call toxic. Now, toxic's a big bad word and it sounds horrible and whatnot, but it can be an underlying current. For example, you can get it sometimes even in families where it's sibling rivalry and things like that. So this toxic thing, to sum it up, it's when a relationship that's in your life, you may see it or may not see it, but it's not good for you or for your life. And it's something that plays against you and causes you to swim upstream a little bit in that relationship.
And it doesn't kind of uplift you. And I think for me as well, when I've thought about this, from a faith perspective, I always would define it as, if there's someone that's bringing you further away from God, that's probably not a good thing. Or further away from feeling, you know, confident about yourself or good about yourself. Or maybe, you know, somebody who, and it's only when you stand back and realize sometimes, when I think of some of the toxic friendships in my life that are no more, that a person brings out the worst in you rather than the best. So you kind of leave your kind of time with them going, oh my gosh, yeah, I just spent the last hour just like gossiping about people and it wasn't nice.
I mean, to sum it up even more, what you just said is that it's somebody that takes you away from what you believe in, and most importantly, what you value. And they will kind of bring you away from those things that you would have deemed at one time very important to you. That's when you know there's something wrong there. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to walk away from that person. It just means that these are red flags, things to address. But first off the bat, of course, if you're in a relationship, this goes without saying, of any sort, and it's causing you physical harm, that is clearly a no-brainer. That's something you got to deal with imminently. And no one should be under physical harm against your will, obviously. So that is obviously a no-brainer. We're going to move past that one. That goes without saying. One of the big things when it comes to relationships, or the toxicity of them, is the trust factor. You know, have you got a right friendship that you can actually trust? Now, I'm not saying, you know, oh, I can trust them with everything and therefore you should tell them everything, but with what you've given them or shared with them, you know, is the trust value there? Because that's a real, I suppose, key of a friendship is trust. And sometimes trust isn't really known until the relationship may be a bit pressed or something like that. I heard an interesting story the other day, a very powerful, should we say, influencer, and they had a best friend. They went through relationship issues, and a newspaper got onto her hairdresser and said, we will promote you and your products if you give us the dirt on what really happened. Spill the beans. Like, now the hairdresser didn't, you know, thankfully. But that is amazing how, you know, because obviously people with money can sometimes be swayed as well. Trust isn't always tested until, isn't always proved until it's really tested. So that's one thing to note as well. But if you're in a friendship or a relationship and you don't have trust, it doesn't mean you have to drop that person or anything. We're not saying that. Just obviously a word to the wise, be careful what you do tell them. You can still have a friendship with someone, but they may not be your inner circle of
when
trust.
Does it get to the point where you do have to walk away? And I think sometimes people find it hard to identify toxic friendships, especially when, say, for example, it's a school friend that's been in your life for years and years, and you're kind of you know each other quite well, but life changes and all that sort of stuff, and you get kind of into a rhythm of a friendship, and a lot of it mightn't be good, and therefore it's even harder to kind of break away. When do you say
absolutely
enough is enough?
I mean, this is the thing, but you know, I suppose life is, I always kind of sum life up like chapters, you know, that's and chapters change, you know what I mean? The story is still pretty much the same, but the chapters may change and the direction may change. So, you know, someone who's your best buddy when you're 15 may not be at 35, you know, they may still be acting like they're 15 when you're 35. You know, obviously we're as young as we feel, but at the same time, there is, just because you've known them a long amount of time, here's my question. I say, well, look, is this person, you're not looking that they're going to give you anything in life, but are they, you know, subtracting from you? Are they causing you, like we said earlier, to pull you away from your beliefs or values? Are they a positive influence in your life, to put it simply, or are they a negative one? And sum it up like that. And if you're going to say, well, most of the time they're grand, it's just the odd time, well, then that's one thing. But if they're constantly what I'd call a negative influence, as in they're bringing you to a place and talking about conversations you don't want to talk about, and they're just getting, I suppose, bringing you on, trying to pull you on a direction you just don't want to go, well, then you need to make an adult decision and say, well, you know what, maybe I might be better off keeping this person at arm's length.
But do you sit down and talk about it as a first port of call? I know it depends on the friendship. I'll give you a good example from my own life. Years ago, when I was coming back into my faith, a really, really good male friend that I had, you know, who used to, as some gentlemen do, or not gentlemen as the case may be, you know, make kind of crude jokes and stuff like that, and I just said, look, that's not my cup of tea anymore, you know, I'm really uncomfortable with that sort of stuff, and just don't do it around me. Now, that could have gone one way or the other, where he, you know, just kind of raised his eyes to heaven. And he, from them, that, he was like, okay, fine. And from that point on, he totally respected that, you know, I had kind of, I suppose, changed in one way. I was their person, but, and he respected that, and our friendship has continued. Now, obviously, it could have gone another direction where I guess it would have shown that he wasn't a true friend if he wasn't going to respect this request.
True.
So can you talk to me, say if it's the gossipy thing, or you know what, you say to the friend, hey Mark, sometimes when we're together, I don't know why, but I just feel like you put me down a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally understand that. I mean, I definitely empathise, because I mean, I know a situation that I experienced, and a person, and they were, you know, I would have been helping them through coaching them and stuff like that, and they were doing so well. They'd leave a coaching session on such a high, you know, and it wasn't a false high, it was just, okay, I have a plan, I know where I'm going, great. They'd get around a particular friend of theirs, and their friend would be like, oh, well, you'll never be a success, and there's no point,
so
don't be wasting.
So they would tear down all that you
and they would
up, yeah.
literally rip it up to shreds, because obviously they had their own issues in their own life, their own beliefs, whatever. And this person said, you know, this is constantly happening. I come away, I'm ready to go until I meet that person. And if it's 3 weeks, I've got 3 weeks of a good 3 weeks until I meet that person. So what you can do is this, a couple of things. First of all, a real friend, a true friend, will hear you. You know, they may not like what you say, but they'll listen to what you say, and they'll, most importantly, they'll respect what you say.
And support you, even if they don't understand
exactly,
or agree.
Exactly, you can agree to disagree. So what happened was, my advice given that particular situation, I said, well, look, here's what you do. You got to broach the situation. You know, have a couple of boundaries in your own head. We're not going to go talking about this, this, and this, and this. And I said, well, maybe don't discuss your goals and your future plans with this person, because they're just not on the same wavelength as you. They haven't got it yet. They're still thinking a certain way. We're not judging them. They're not less than us, and we're not casting, you know, we're not seeing ourselves as better than them. We're just going to not talk about that around them unless they bring it up, and then we'll kind of keep it short. But do, if you can't avoid certain topics, well, then you're going to have to broach it with them and say, you know what, listen, what about looking at it like this? What you don't want is a finger-pointing situation. You always cause me to be negative. You always pull me down. That's going to cause a friction. That's going to cause problems.
So what language do you use then?
So the language is the language of love. You know, the clear line of any sort of good communication is when it's not in a tense situation, when it's, you know, the way you don't agree with what I believe, blah, 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 like, right? Say your situation or this situation I was giving off a coaching client. Well, you know the way you don't like the way I'm always talking about my plans for the future, you don't like the goals, and you think it won't work. Well, I think it will work. So can we agree to disagree, and let's not rip each other's ideas down, and do it in a loving way. Don't do it in the accusational way of, oh, you're so negative, oh, you don't have a clue. You want to do it in that way where it's a communicative environment. Now, if in the sense of they're still resistive, some people are very hard-necked and won't listen, you know, they've got the blinders on, well, then you're going to have to make a decision on, well, look, I keep these at arm's length, maybe these aren't in my...
Or sometimes you need a break rather than a breakup. Yeah,
exactly, just like friends. Ross and Rachel, that was
we
so funny.
Are on a
we were on
break.
A break! But, you know, here's one of the biggest things when it comes to relationships that I've got to touch on, and that is jealousy. Because, you know, there's a quote I shared a long time ago, and it said this, and I read it somewhere, so I didn't make it up or anything, but the quote said, go where you're celebrated, not just tolerated. Because sometimes friends, they want friends so they'll have you around, and you may even be what they consider their best friend. They just don't know what a best friend really is. But they'll have you around, but they get jealous, like, oh, look at them, you know. And there's two things. There's jealousy and there's envy. Jealousy is when you want what the other person has. Envy is where you want what they have and you don't think they deserve what they have. Envy is the real,
which is totally contrary
one.
To wanting to, in real friendship, always want the good of the other person and want what's best for the other person.
And this is the thing, like, I remember one particular situation, and the person got some great news, the couple got some great news, and they shared it with other couple friends. They got the keys to their house and they were like, oh my goodness, we got it, I can't believe, let's go celebrate. And another couple who was trying to get a house as well doesn't show up to the celebrations. They've been friends forever, even before they were in relationships. And they're like, why didn't you show up? Then they tried to get, you know, to start a conversation with them. They're texting and they're like, just not really reciprocating the conversation. They're like, they're gone to ground a little bit. Okay, give them time. They'll come back around. And through the jigs and the reels, it never really came out. But what did come out was a little statement that was said one time. And it was like, oh, you've got your house now. Oh, you think you're great now. And here's us trying to get our house. And it was clearly there was jealousy that was clearly the problem.
Yeah.
Now, if they go in saying, oh, don't be jealous, that will destroy a friendship. So you've got to pick your battles. Some things aren't worth fighting about. And I will say this, when you're shouting about good news, you know, bear in mind, not everyone may be shouting with you.
But true friends will always celebrate.
Absolutely, for sure.
What was the phrase, Mark? Celebrate the good, not just tolerate.
Go where you're celebrated, not tolerated.
Good stuff. Excuse me. Okay, so.
I need you to get your drink of water here.
So, Mark, come here. You're always the innovator. You're brilliant on social media.
Oh,
and you're doing something you'll have to explain to me, bit of a Luddite when it comes to Instagram, is you are doing an Insta Live session at 8:30 tonight. What is an Insta Live session
okay.
and what is going to happen? What are you going to be covering?
Okay, basically, right? So, for those of you who know, those of you who don't know, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook. Mark's Happy Place on Instagram, right? Go over and follow us there. Anyway, tonight at 8:30 p.m., I always believe, you know, very much like you guys do here, in you've got to be doing something charitable if you're going to be doing anything at all. It's not about making money, it's about making a difference. So what I wanted to do was, I said, you know what, there's a lot of people, I coach a lot of people, but then there's some people who maybe not be able to afford the coaching, or they're maybe not knowing exactly what it is. So I said, well, here's what I'm going to do tonight at 8:30 p.m. on my Instagram. I'm going to do a live coaching session. Now, I'm not doing it with a person. I'm going to be doing it with everyone who's watching. It's going to be like a general life coaching session. So you can tune in. I'm going to be talking about tools, about evaluating your own life and kind of finding out where you want to go. A lot of people, they'll come to myself as a coach and they'll say, you know, I don't know where I'm at. I don't know where if I'm coming or going, what my plans are. And, you know,
they're looking for direction.
They just don't know where they're at. They're coasting along in life, but they've no clear plan or direction. Mm. Well, tonight we're going to find out that plan and direction.
Help people
get
to go where they want to go. And of course,
it's free.
You can also catch Mark and Fiona on the This Adult Life podcast. Lots of really great topics and more time to kind of really delve into them as well. So, Mark, lots going on for you. Busy man, as always. And as Mark said, you can catch him tonight on Instagram at Insta Live, a session tonight at 8:30. His Instagram is Mark's Happy Place and the podcast is called This Adult Life. Mark Fennell, life coach as always, thank you so much for joining us on Spirit
Radio.
Thank
you as always.
We have a very interesting Life in Five guest today, and not only has he very recently just been baptised, and we're going to hear all about that journey, but he's also running in the EU elections, probably one of the younger people to be running in the elections. It's great to see young people entering into politics, so I'm sure we'll touch on that as well in our Life in Five chat. How does it work? Well, we get people into studio and we say, tell us about yourself and your life, and they pick a few questions that they answer, and that's how we get to know them better. So it's great to have with me in studio as our Life in Five guest, Ben Scanlon. Good morning, Ben. Morning to you.
Good morning and congratulations on the baby. I had no idea that you were so far along.
I think it's very, very obvious now that I'm quite heavily pregnant. You know, when you're in the first few months, people they're kind of in that, is she, isn't she? No, it's pretty obvious. I'm into my 9th month of pregnancy now. It is actually technically 10 months of pregnancy, by the way, because it's 40 weeks, which is 10 months. But it's not about me this morning. It's about you, Ben. So just before we get into your question, just tell us about yourself.
Well, as you said, my name is Ben Scallon. I'm 21. I campaigned quite heavily to retain the 8th Amendment. And after that result, I was so shocked that I decided to get more politically active. I think it's really important that young people kind of engage with politics, because so often they just support the consensus and whatever is the prevailing, zeitgeist at the time. So I wanted to kind of have a more conservative or traditionalist voice from that perspective. So
did you find yourself kind of as a lone wolf? You're studying in college at the moment.
I was studying in college at that time, and yeah, it was, I mean, almost everybody I knew in college would have been quite pro-choice, and it's kind of an anomaly almost, being a young person who is willing to deviate from the mainstream positions. But yeah, I think also you mentioned I'm running for the Europeans. Technically not, I'm running as a replacement candidate for Mr. Herman Kelly with the Irish Freedom Party.
So how does that work then?
So it's like if you have a president and a vice president. So I'm on the ticket, but I'm the number two guy. So he gets the seat, but I would step into if he decides to resign or something happens down the line, then I would take his place. That's kind of how it works.
Does that mean if he gets elected, you're kind of working alongside him, or how does that work? You only have to step in to the breach if needed.
I think it's more kind of technicality, but still, I mean, I'm campaigning with him. We've been going all up and down the city doing leafleting and things like that.
So you're in the
videos.
Dublin electoral area for the European elections with Herman Kelly. And so, when you're knocking on doors, what sort of issues are coming up then, Ben?
Lots of issues. I mean, people are just angry, I think, with the political establishment at this point. That tends to be it's just general frustration at the fact that they all seem to kind of be clones of each other, and none of them are really willing to address they're not willing to really contradict each other. There's so much consensus. We're all about diversity in this country, but not so much diversity of thought. And I think that we could do with a bit more of that. So my party is calling for Ireland to leave the European Union, for example, which is considered very controversial. And I mean, it's not a common opinion, but it's certainly different. You can't say that we're just running with the with the herd.
You're not going with the flow, that's for sure. Well, we'll get into some of your questions. I'm sure some of those things will be weaved into our chat as well, Ben, as we continue our conversation today. Your first question that you picked was a person who had a big influence on you.
Absolutely. I think that there's a Christian apologist named David Wood, and he's from a group called Act 17 Apologetics, and he's a Protestant. I was recently baptized as a Roman Catholic, but I have a lot of respect for, I had a lot of respect for that man, because he showed me through YouTube videos a kind of more intellectual side of Christianity that I wasn't aware of existed. I always thought of it as kind of hocus pocus and superstition.
So were you brought up with any faith at all, Ben?
I was raised Buddhist for most of my life. My mother was a lifelong atheist. My father was a Buddhist. And I just started watching videos by this guy. And it completely blew me away, some of the arguments.
And kind of coming at it from an intellectual way, you know, the explaining, you know, what the Christian faith is and why it is the truth.
Sure, absolutely. The historical evidence for it.
Was there kind of a light bulb moment, or was it a more gradual thing for you?
It was quite gradual. I think after about maybe 6 to 7 months of watching this guy, my whole family, we used to watch it around the dinner table, like debates and things like that.
How'd that go down?
It was interesting, because like my dad's a nerd, as am I, so he used to do it just for intellectual purposes, just to learn more. And then after about, again, 6 or 7 months, I like came out to my family as like, guys, I'm Christian now. And it turns out they had all had the exact same experience independently of one another. Like, we hadn't really talked about it that much. No. And so that was like the first domino where it's like, oh, I guess we're a Christian family now. So now my like formerly atheist mom prays for me. My dad was born, like, he was baptized at birth and he gave it up later. He's come back to the faith. So it's kind of incredible. It's weird. A lot of people, they make that journey, but then they don't have anyone like-minded to go home to, whereas God has blessed me to have, you know, support in my own household.
Your family going on different journeys, but still similar in a way. So baptized at 21 after, and we must look up David Wood now. He sounds really interesting. Looking forward to tuning into that. And of course, when you are baptized within the Catholic Church, you kind of have to do pretty much kind of exams. Like, you have to study, and it's not just a kind of step right up and we'll baptize you. How does it work?
Yeah, I literally, when I first decided to make the step, I thought that I was just going to, you know, call somebody up, book it for next week, and then I just received the divine dunking. But it was months and months of catechism. I actually meant to do it last year, and I missed, there was a form I had to send in, and I missed the deadline. It's that like bureaucratic. There's so much more red tape than you would imagine, but it's good because it makes you really question, like, do I want this? Is this serious? Like, it's good that they put obstacles in the way within reason, so that you don't just get people walking in. Like, they want to make sure you understand what you're signing up to, and I think I do. So I'm just happy to have received that beautiful sacrament. You know,
wow, fantastic, and lovely to hear that story as well. The next question you picked is a time you heard something clear from God.
Absolutely. I think God, I've obviously never heard voices. I've never experienced anything supernatural. But I think God speaks to all of us through the Bible, in the sense that it's a universal document. It deals with issues that people dealt with thousands of years ago, that they deal with today, and that they'll probably be dealing with 1,000 years from now as well. You know, like love, loss, betrayal, all these types of things. So I remember yesterday in confession, it was my first ever confession just yesterday, and I went in and I was bawling my eyes out. I'm not like a sappy or sentimental person, but I have no shame saying that. It was just, I was rattling off all the sins that I've ever done in my rotten life. And then when you hear the words, you know, I absolve you. And he read the priest, he was a Filipino priest, he read a passage about Jesus not condemning the adulterous woman. And that was surreal. That really, you know, even though he was speaking to her 2,000 years ago, he's speaking to me now.
And you really felt that.
Absolutely. It was so impactful. And I think that it's something that every Christian has experienced, that you're reading a book that was written millennia ago, but it's like it could have been written yesterday. It could be somebody talking to you right now. So yeah, that would be a time that I heard God.
And the third one that you have picked, your third question today, Ben Scallon, is a favorite Bible verse and why?
I think it's the one about loving your enemies and praying for those who persecute you, which is that's kind of cliched to an extent. It's probably the most well-known Jesus quotation. But what I found amazing about that was he doesn't say be nice to your enemies. He doesn't say be kind to them. He says love them, which is an internal thing. You know, it's no good to be helping people if in the back of your head you're thinking, oh, that guy's a scumbag. You know, I hope he trips and breaks his neck. Like, it's that really had me, I had to reassess what Christianity meant after reading that and realizing that it's about actually becoming a better person, not just going through the motions and behaving in a way that deceives people, but actually becoming a saint, that's a hard teaching. You know, it's not easy. And in fact, at first it seems impossible, but with his help, you can actually do it. And I've already started to see small changes in myself. Nothing like where I want to be. Hopefully it won't stop there. But yeah, it's really incredible. I found that quite profound.
And it's a challenge as well, and something that you have to really, as you say, it's one of the kind of common, you know, pieces of scripture that a lot of people might know, but living it out is very different to actually knowing it in the first place. Okay, so the fourth question you've picked is how God helps you in your work.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, at the minute, my work, again, it's very political, and I think that without God, none of us would be able to subject ourselves to the times that we live in today. I mean, who would willingly stand up and say, I'm pro-life, when you know that like 2/3 of the population are going to be against you, or, you know, and the media backlash that comes with that, or any of these positions? Like, it's controversial to be a Christian, which is how it should be. I mean, if
it's always been controversial, though, hasn't it?
It's always been. I mean, it's a subversive ideology by its nature. People don't want to hear the truth. And so I think we've always been at odds, no matter what society we're in, be it far left, far right, you know, communist, Nazi, no matter what like age you live in, you're going to have to stand up and take certain blows and risks to your reputation.
So you know what you're signing up for. I mean, you're just baptized, Ben, and you realize that it's sometimes not going to be an easy road.
No, not at all. If I wanted an easy road, I certainly wouldn't have picked this religion, I'll put it that way. No, it'll be worth it in the end. That's what I have faith in.
So what makes you happy is the final question you've picked today as our Life in Five guest.
What makes me happy is having a sense of purpose, and I think that Christianity gives me that. I think a lot of young people, they suffer from depression. I know I certainly did in my teen years, for years. I mean, there's a deep spiritual crisis at the heart of our society, and it's because people don't have any kind of objectivity or meaning in their life. They don't. I mean, you think that having no moral compass and being able to do whatever you want is liberation, but it's slavery. I mean, when you're just a slave to your passions and there's no constraints on you whatsoever, how could anybody feel fulfilled, you know, in those circumstances? So I think that the boundaries given by Christianity and the moral framework laid out, it gives a sense of purpose that gives a deep, meaningful happiness, as opposed to the happiness that comes out of a bottle or a pill.
So do you think then there's that misconception of, you know, Christianity being all no's and rules and, you know, means your life is going to be so, you know, boring and all that sort of stuff?
I definitely think that's a misconception. It's not about arbitrary rules. Like I say, it's about being a better person. It's about changing who you are and how you interact with the world. And I think that, you know, nobody can deny that that's a good thing. And when you look at the effect that it's had on the world in terms of charity, I believe there's a few gentlemen coming in after me who will be talking about some charitable work that they do. It sounds amazing. You know, what would inspire somebody to do that? What would inspire them to build a basilica, or, you know, like Notre Dame, which unfortunately, you know, it had its, like, we all were paying attention to it because it's this beautiful work of architecture, who would start making a building that they knew they were never going to finish. You know, some of these take hundreds of years to build. Only somebody who had a belief in something transcendent and greater than themselves would be willing to do that. And
how has it changed you?
How has it changed
me? It's a big question, I know, and I'm sure the long answer and the short answer, but if you could sum it up in terms of just that, because it's fascinating that you've recently kind of become a Christian, you've been baptized. How has it changed your life and you as a person?
I'm more humble, and I think I'm a lot not in a negative, I think when some people hear this they think of it in a very negative way. They think, oh, you're being down on yourself. I'm really not. It's more, I realize how far I have to go. When you start off, you think, oh yeah, I'm a pretty good person. You know, I don't kill anybody. I don't sell drugs to cartels or anything. So I must be good, right? And then you become a Christian and you start to be more conscious of your actual life and the way you interact with people. And you think, I don't know.
I've got some work to do, but are you a happier person?
Much happier person. I've never been happier. I've never been more fulfilled. I've never been more positive and optimistic about the future. And I'm very hopeful for, you know, things to come.
Well, Ben, thanks so much for sharing with us as our Life in 5 guest today. I've been chatting to Ben Scanlon, our Life in 5 guest, and one of the things that he mentioned, just if you joined us halfway through the interview, as he shared with us a little bit about his own conversion and recently baptised just this past Easter at 21, was a gentleman called David Wood. Has some very good videos on YouTube, really good from the apologetics point of view from the Christian faith, so definitely might be something that you want to check out. Ben, thanks for joining us on Spirit Radio. Guests have been involved with establishing and running a service called Street Pastors in Dublin. It's already up and running in Cork and Belfast for quite some time. And one of our guests, finding faith has certainly changed the course of his life. And you know, there was an interesting story in the newspaper today, a proposal about staggering the opening times of bars and clubs. Yesterday, there's an article about women being one of the biggest binge drinkers here in Ireland when you compare it to Europe, and just things about antisocial behaviour, all that sort of stuff. And often in the early hours of the morning on a Friday or Saturday night, I think a lot of people can find themselves in a vulnerable position, and that's one of the things that this group is trying to do, is trying to reach out to those who might be a little bit vulnerable. In studio to chat to us, we have Tomás Jenkinson and Stuart Harvey. Thank you both for joining us on Spirit Radio this morning.
Lovely to meet you.
So I might start with you, Stuart. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Stuart, 50 years old, from Belfast. Lived in Belfast all my life, and I've been serving with Street Pastors now for just over 4 years.
And how did you get involved with Street Pastors? Let's go back a bit, because you weren't always kind of that connected to your faith.
No, I sort of originally became a Christian at 16, but it was like a tick box Christianity. It was just to pray a wee bit in the morning, read a couple of verses, and that was my day. That was it. There was no real connection with God. So I had no real roots, nothing solid, and my life started to go downhill. I was introduced to drink, and drink sort of became my life. I'd done a lot of drinking, heavy drinking, and with my involvement in supporting a local football team, getting into football violence, and just really had lost my way up until about 8 years ago, and it was actually at a football match here in Dublin that I was in a bad fight with a guard, and my wife and sons were there in the stand, and I was going home on the bus that night, and someone had challenged me about my behaviour, and I just thought, Jesus, how did I get here? Heavenly Father, how did my life end up this lost?
That was kind of a turning point for you then.
And that was a major turning point. The couple of days after that, my wife had taken me to a life group in church, and I watched a couple of people there who actually were texting me this morning, and I saw Jesus in their lives, and I thought, why can't I be like that? Why can't I have a faith and a life like they have? And then I'd met another guy to walk through the church a few days later in the Moor Mountains, a guy, Alan, and he had asked me, how are you spiritually? And I thought, Alan, I'm down and out, I'm lost, I'm just gone, there's nothing. And he opened the Bible and read to me from Luke 15, the story of the prodigal son. And it was just a wee bit where it said about the father ran out to meet the son while he was a long way off and had compassion on him. And then they ended up celebrating his return. And I thought, what is God like? Who is God? I had always this vision that God was this big angry judge, and he was angry with me and I'd really let him down. But it's not like that at all. And it was then that I discovered the reality of who God is and what Jesus had done, and my life just turned then.
So that was kind of the beginning of this personal relationship, really, which was the thing that made a difference. And I mean, if you can compare your life before this, Stuart, and then after, what does that look like?
It was a complete turnaround. It was people nicknamed me, even family members. My nickname was Hate, the word I did hate. I just hated people. And that a lot of that stems away back right up till I was about 20. I was badly bullied, whether it was at school or work, wherever I was just picked on, bullied. I don't know why, but it was really awful, and it filled me full of resentment, hatred, bitterness and anger. But after this turnaround, and I discovered this love of God and his love for me, something happened inside. I just softened, and it wasn't for me, it was just the Holy Spirit working on my life to change me, and I developed a passion for people. Not only was it a passion for Jesus Christ and serving him, but it was a passion for the people and everyone I saw, and I went from hating people to loving people.
And that obviously changed you as well, you know, as in terms of just your, I would imagine, your happiness in everyday life.
Yeah, I'd always heard people talking about having joy in the Lord and joy, and I think we're created to search for joy, but we can only find it in one place, and that is in God. And I'd actually discovered it. I'd always thought, I want the life of joy that I didn't have. And I think that's my involvement in street pastors now. When I'm out, you see people everywhere searching for joy and drink and drugs and sex, but there's only one place you can find the true joy, and I've found it, thankfully.
Thank God. And as you say, a lot of people looking for happiness in the wrong places, which is not entirely disconnected to the work that Dublin Street Pastors does. Maybe Tomás, you'll tell us a little bit about Dublin Street Pastors and what it's all about.
Yeah, but before that, I just want to say how I connected with Stuart. I was up to do an observer night in Belfast as part of the training to become a street pastor, and I found myself in the company of Big Stuart, as he's known, and he shared with me how in his journey he had often been on the side of the street getting sick and just really in a bad situation. And it was people in a ministry like street pastors, besides these other brothers and sisters in Christ who had witnessed, who had come alongside him and cleaned him up, and who had challenged him in what he was living, in the choice he was making. And he said to me, I realized then, Tomás, that I could end up in prison, I could end up killing somebody, and what would happen to my sons and my wife. And it was then through these people on the streets meeting me, cleaning me up in my own sick, that Jesus met me in person. And I was so touched by that story. And he said, I went on then to become a street pastor, to train, and not only that, but to become a team leader. And now recently Stuart has been taken on the role of becoming a trainer across this island, where he's going out and formulating the training and presenting it to people who volunteer to be trained as street pastors. So I used Stuart's testimony when I'm making the pitch in the churches, when we go around and say, look, how about you getting involved in this amazing opportunity to be Jesus on the street. And I tell Stuart's story and it goes down a bomb, you know.
And that's probably a good way of putting it. Be Jesus on the street. It could be at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know. As I often say in the show, I'm an accidental pioneer. Obviously I'm at the moment being, you know, about to pop in terms of pregnancy, but if you ever are on this, wherever you live, but certainly going out in a night out with sober eyes on, it can be really upsetting just to see the obvious kind of pain that people are going through, the hurt that they're carrying, and probably trying to drown that often with alcohol or drugs or whatever the case may be. But of course, if Jesus is on the streets, he wouldn't reach out to people in judgment.
No. So, I mean, that was Jesus' mandate, you know, and that's why the Pharisees were so upset with him. You know, how come he's hanging out with all of these kind of wrong living people? And Jesus' answer was, well, you know, the healthy don't need a doctor, it's the sick. But Jesus is the same today, and he's presenting himself through the likes of us. And we go out and we are, just kind of engaging with people. Jesus, he wants to be where people are. He wants to be involved in their life. He wants to catch the pulse of the life of the people of Ireland. And in that, engaging and stepping in, I was thinking, you know, Jesus, he didn't only step out of heaven into earth. He stepped, you know, from the church out into the parties and the wildness and the brokenness and the pain of our city of Dublin, which is, you know, common to all cities. And he steps into that. Not in a judgmental way. This is what attracted me to street pastors. We do not judge. We do not make a decision about what
people
are.
So you're not kind of stopping people starting to preach the gospel to them. You know, you're living the gospel rather than preaching it.
The motto is to care, listen and help. So, you know, there's not even the agenda to go out and to evangelize in that context. It's to care, listen and help. That's our mandate. But as you care, listen and help, you're guaranteed that people will sit up and pay attention and be touched. And then they'll ask you the question. And it's like an invitation. Please tell me,
why you are giving up your night to look after me and the likes of my friends and others in distress. And you can say, well, I once was like you, but I found a better party. This party is not the party.
And that's probably something that you can identify with, Stuart, where you might see somebody who is quite vulnerable, maybe had a lot to drink, and you can see, you know, parts of your past in that. But what happens kind of on a Dublin street pastor night? How does it, I know every night is different, but what in general can you expect, and what, how does it work then?
There's not really a set pattern on any night. You go out, we meet for prayer for half an hour before we go out, and then we just go out onto the streets and ask God to lead us where he wants us to be. And we're just there to help and care, to care for, to listen to, and to help anyone we come across in whatever situation. And you discover as you go out that everybody is nearly wearing a mask. Behind every face there's something going on, and people are really willing to open up. And I think when we take our time to help people who are sick, who are ill, who are in trouble, even helping people with simple things like directions to a hotel, helping them to find a taxi, people notice this and then they start asking the question of why you're doing it. Yeah. And that's when you get to share the story.
And there are serious incidents, you know, that come up. You know, one incident was a young woman who was not in a great state, and three older gentlemen came and offered to lift her up, and then were escorting her up the street when the street pastor team came along it, alongside, and they interrupted these three men to discover that she didn't know any of them, talked to the woman. They then called the night man who was at the club, which he'd come out of, and together with this doorman, they were able to, in a kind of calm way, retrieve the woman from these three men. And then when the men were gone, she told them that, where she was staying wasn't in that direction, and her friends appeared shortly after that, and they were very concerned for her, and they said, look, they were taking her in the opposite direction of where she should be going. And so that's kind of like a rescue situation that takes place.
So do you work then with the Gardaí when there's things like that, where someone might be in trouble?
Look,
you know,
when it gets to a certain point, you know, we do call the guards, but we're also kind of trying to say, well, the guards are at a max, they're maxed out, and they've got some very serious things to deal with. So there is a very good relationship, a partnership almost between us and the guards, in that they're looking after the harder situations, and then if we need them for the softer situation because it becomes hard, we can call on them. But it means that they are freed up, and the emergency services, like we have basic first aid, we can look after people, patch them up, we can get them home, we can call a friend or a mother to come
so
in.
So you are the physician in the practical sense as well as the spiritual sense then.
Just really serving in the best ways that
are. And what sort of a reaction do you get? I know you wear your high-vis jackets that says that you're street pastors, and obviously you're chatting to people in different situations. What do people think of what you're up to?
Well, it's quite a kind of a magnet, really, because people are intrigued. Like, people are out to celebrate and to party and have fun. And, you know, the hen parties and the stag parties stand out, we stand out. And people come over, and because they've had a few jars and that, they're relaxed and they want to chill, they want to get a photo with you, you know, a selfie. And then you can chat about why they're out to party. One night we were out, and these group of girls were over from England, the bride-to-be and her bridesmaids. And we were able to hear a little bit about that. And I offered to say, look, I don't know whether you're a person of faith. And she interrupted, oh, yeah, I'm getting married in the church. Well, I said, look, I'm celebrating 30 years being married to the most wonderful woman I know. And we've five grown kids. And I said, you know, I got together with a bottle of champagne. And I said, kids, the reason mum and dad are together 30 years this year is because of Jesus. Mm. And if you'd like, I could say a little prayer for your upcoming marriage. She said, yeah, we'd love that. So all the bridesmaids and the bride held hands with us, the street pastors, and there on the street, we prayed to bless this lovely girl, Jenny, for her upcoming marriage, and that it would be a great success.
Which is a lovely story, because in those situations, as in when you ask somebody, would you like me to say a prayer for you, and they say yes, people are hungry for prayer.
Yeah, yeah.
People are hungry for prayer, and quite often people come and ask us for prayer.
They're the ones reaching out to you.
Yes, people are coming to us and asking us for prayer for exams, young people asking us for prayer for ill relatives, asking us for prayer for their futures, asking us to bless marriages, homes. It happens quite often that they actually come to us.
So a privilege in a way to be part of those things. So I know Dublin Street Pastors is going to be launching on Wednesday the 15th of May. So what's the launch about and who's it for?
Okay, it's, well, we're celebrating some many years. It's been 3 years. We thought it would have happened a bit earlier, there were just different technicalities and things to be established with the guards and protocols, but we're ready to go now. And so we're celebrating the work that's gone into to this stage, and we're also celebrating the 16 candidates who will be commissioned. We've four others in the wings who just have to complete a little observer night, but we have these 16 ready to be commissioned. We have Les Isaacs, who's the founder and the kind of father of Street Pastor Vision, a big black guy who's a great man to deliver an inspiring word, grew up in Jamaica, he was born in Jamaica, grew up in the inner city of London, and started Street Pastors to respond to the murders on the Brixton Mile. And this thing has gone viral around the UK and around the world as well. It's starting to go around the world. But he's coming over, giving the keynote address. We've got dignitaries. We've got the chief superintendent. No, he's now the commissioner, praise the Lord. The commissioner, Pat Leahy, who's over the metropolitan area of all of Dublin, right under Drew Harris. We have Michael Jackson and some other representatives from high up in the Catholic quarters. So we've got, and all the churches represented, and the families, and it's there to just thank God for what has taken place to get us this far, and to celebrate that, but also to look at where we're going. We are actually now bringing at last this wonderful service of Jesus to Dublin, to the capital of our nation, and we're going to have that on next Wednesday, 7:30, the service begins, so be there a bit earlier, and we're going to then be commissioned, and we'll be going out on the first Saturday after that, the 18th.
So
Saturday night after that.
Praying for that first
time. People are welcome. Just want to say, you are welcome in the city or outside the city. Come and be part of this celebration. Christchurch Cathedral, 7:30, the service starts on Wednesday, the 15th of May. And if you're not able to come, keep us in prayer. We appreciate prayer. Prayer is foundational. There's a thing called prayer pastors, another team, prayer pastors. And if you feel like you mightn't be a street pastor, but you are a prayer pastor, let us know. We'll give you the contact details when Wendy finishes up here.
Fantastic stuff. Well, we will be praying for that first night on the 18th of May out, when you'll be out on the streets of Dublin. Thank you so much to Tomás Jenkinson and Stuart Harvey for telling us a little bit about Dublin Street Pastors, which, as Tomás mentioned, they will be having their official launch and commissioning service on the 15th of May. And if you want to get in touch with the Dublin Street Pastors, you can go to the website, which is streetpastors.org, and you'll be able to see on there how to get in touch with the Dublin team, and facebook.com/Dublin Street Pastors, or email Dublin@streetpastors.org. Thank you both.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.